Israel bombs Rafah, sparking fears the ground invasion is close behind.
Displaced Gaza and Jamil Abu Houri said the intensification of airstrikes was Israel's way of showing its disdain for a UN Security Council resolution last week.
New York City to charge for driving in Manhattan.
New York has more traffic than any place in the United States, and now we're doing something about it.
And why the people who keep the time think they may have to subtract a second from the world's clocks. It's called a negative leap second. Also, when they think it might happen. Today is Thursday, March 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israel bombed at least three homes in Rafah overnight, raising new fears that a long-threatened ground assault could be coming. More now from Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan.
Gazans in Rafah on Wednesday inspected the damage caused by Israeli strikes overnight. The newest round of bombardment raised fears among those sheltering in the last refuge on the southern edge of the enclave that a ground assault could be coming. Displaced Gazan Jamil Abu Houri said the intensification of airstrikes was Israel's way of showing its disdain for a UN Security Council resolution last week, demanding an immediate ceasefire. He fears next stop would be a ground assault on Rafah, which Israel has threatened to carry out, despite pleas from its closest ally, Washington, that this would cause too much harm to civilians. Look at our little ones, look at our children, where should we go? Abu Houri said. Separately, in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, which has seen worsening bloodshed in parallel with the Gaza war, the Palestinian Health Ministry said on Wednesday, at least three were killed by Israeli fire during a raid in Jenin overnight. This Palestinian woman's son was one of them. At least 32,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's offensive into Hamas-run Gaza, according to the health ministry there. Thousands of other dead are believed to be unrecovered under rubble. The war began after Hamas fighters raided Israel on October 7th, killing 1,200 people and abducting 253 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. Israeli forces just north of Rafah kept the two main hospitals in Khan Yunis, El Amal, and Nasser Hospital under a blockade imposed late last week. In the north, they were still operating inside Al Shifa, the enclave's largest hospital, which they stormed more than a week ago. Israel says the hospitals have been used by Hamas fighters, which Hamas and medical staff deny.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. Israel has asked the United States to reschedule a meeting on the Rafah military plans.
The Prime Minister's office has agreed to reschedule the meeting dedicated to Rafah. So we're now working with them to find a convenient date that's obviously going to work for both sides.
White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with a bipartisan U.S. congressional delegation in Jerusalem on Wednesday, downplaying concerns from the Biden administration over an Israeli ground invasion of Rafah, saying civilians will be able to flee the fighting.
All of the Gaza Strip north of Rafah, you know, people move down, they can move back up. They don't have to go into north of Wadi Gaza, but there's still 65% of the Gaza Strip left open. And people just move. They move with their tents. They have no place to go. Yes, they have a place to go. Second, you know, we provide them food. The problem was not the entry of trucks. The problem was the stealing of trucks, both by looting by Hamas and looting by others and so on.
Netanyahu also addressed the issue of getting aid into Gaza, as you heard there at the end, saying aid is getting in, but not getting to those who need it. VOA's Steve Karish, host of Flashpoint Global Crises, talked with VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about aid and the Israeli government.
Well, Israel says they're not limiting the aid, that everything has to be inspected. And once it's inspected, people are free to, to distribute it wherever they want, including in northern Gaza. At the same time, Israel has encouraged people to move to the south. There are now in Rafah almost 1.5 million Palestinians. Israel says the problem is not the aid. The problem is the distribution, that the UN is not able to distribute it, and that Hamas is looting the trucks. Israel says that in the last couple of weeks, they have significantly increased the amount of aid that can get in, and that if there's a bottleneck, it's not Israel's fault.
You said that Israel says they have increased the aid going into Gaza. Is there any evidence of this?
Well, there's an organization called COGAT, which is the Israeli branch of the Israeli army that deals with Palestinian issues. And they always say the number of trucks that are getting into Gaza that they've allowed through Kerem Shalom. But they say that the problem is that even if the trucks are getting through the Israeli crossing, they're not necessarily able to get from the Israeli crossing to Gaza to distribute it, especially in northern Gaza. So they say every day that more than 100 trucks are coming in, or 200 trucks are coming in, but it's not clear if those trucks are actually getting to where they need to go or what's happening. And there are cases of Hamas looting the trucks. And just to go back for a minute to the airdrops, apparently even once Palestinians succeed in getting food from the airdrops, there are sometimes stampedes. There are so many people waiting, and people can actually be robbed on the way home as well, and the food aid stolen from them. I mean, the situation is just desperate.
The situation of aid came up yesterday in the conversations between Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and American Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. Austin saying that there just isn't enough aid getting in. Why can't the Israelis do more?
Well, I guess they could do more. They say they're doing everything they can. I mean, again, there's an objective problem, which is that the people in Gaza are starving. And then there's the question of who's responsible for that. They say that once the aid is inspected, there's no problem. And although, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was at the Egyptian side of Rafah and saw, hundreds of trucks lined up there waiting to get in. So it's not clear exactly what's happening, but what is clear is that not enough aid is getting in, and that Israel is, could do more, and that the airdrops are not efficient. So that's what we know. Who's responsible? It's really not clear.
VOA's Linda Gradstein talking with the host of VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises, Steve Karish. We're following these other stories from around the world. Opposition candidate Bassirou Diomaye won over 54% of votes in Senegal's presidential election, with the ruling coalition candidate taking over 35%. The Dakar Appeals Court said on Wednesday the results were based on vote tallies from 100% of the polling stations. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said on Wednesday she is not ready to discuss potential moves to retaliate over China's excess manufacturing capacity and subsidies that are flooding global markets. She said she wants constructive talks on the issue with Chinese officials during her next visit to Beijing. In the United States, a single ticket for a lottery jackpot is worth a hefty $1.13 billion. It's the fifth largest prize in the game's history and was sold in the eastern U.S. state of New Jersey. Germany and Europe must boost the production of weapons, this according to the German Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck.
In light of the backdrop, which is threatening and not good when we look at Russia, we must increase, both in Germany and in Europe, the production of goods which boost the country's security.
He was meeting with arms industry representatives. It has been over a year now since Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovitz was jailed by Russia. VOA's Christina Casado-Smith says his family and colleagues are still fighting for his release.
In a Moscow courtroom, American journalist Ivan Gorshkovich is told he will spend another 3 months behind bars. But U.S. Ambassador to Russia Lynn Tracy says it is time for Moscow to let Gorshkovich go.
The Russian government has yet to present any evidence to substantiate its accusations. No justification for Evan's continued detention, and no explanation as to why Evan, doing his job as a journalist, constituted a crime.
Ever since his arrest on assignment in a city about 1,600 kilometers east of Moscow on March 29 last year, his family and colleagues have been pushing for the Wall Street Journal reporter's release. The past year has been a constant stream of interviews, news briefings, and private meetings, including with President Joe Biden. Holding back tears, Daniel Gorshkovich describes the toll on the family and the letters that she writes to keep her brother company.
I think we're just mainly trying to support one another and make each other laugh. I'm just in awe of him.
Russia accuses Gorshkovich of espionage, charges that he and his paper deny. Moscow courts repeatedly denied him bail, even as the U.S. declares him wrongfully detained. The general counsel for his media outlet says the legal process is opaque. They must wait for Russia to say when the case can move forward. Jason Conti is general counsel for the Wall Street Journal parent company, Dow Jones.
And at some point, they will pivot to say, okay, the investigation's done and we can do a trial. We just don't know when that will be.
For the family, the waiting is hard. Again, Daniel Gorshkovich.
Of course, we follow the news every day, but it can be just up and down emotionally. So it's just best to just continue to stay focused on this eventual goal and just take it day by day.
If convicted, Gorshkovich could face up to 20 years in prison. But he is not the only American journalist detained in Russia. Alsu Kurmasheva, an editor for VOA sister network RFE/RL, has spent more than 5 months in prison. The American-Russian journalist faces multiple charges, including failing to register as a foreign agent. If convicted, she could face up to 15 years in prison. In Gorshkovich's case, his media company says lawyers inside Russia keep them updated as much as possible. Again, Jason Conti.
And they're great, brave lawyers. There's a limit in what they can say because of the nature of the charges. They're just not allowed to talk about it, given the nature of alleged espionage, which we think, again, is bogus. But those are the nature of the charges, and so they're really not able to talk much about the substance of the case.
When American TV personality Tucker Carlson interviewed President Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader implied that Moscow would be willing to free Gorshkovich in exchange of a convicted killer held in Germany. Since then, there have been no public updates on the diplomatic negotiations. Meanwhile, even Gorshkovich's family, friends, and colleagues keep hoping for his prompt release, amplifying his case to the world, highlighting that when authorities in Russia or any country detain a journalist, it has a chilling effect. Foreign media may leave, local reporters may self-censor, and audiences are left in the dark. Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. You know, when I was a reporter in New York City, back in the 1980s, they started talking about charging people to drive into Midtown Manhattan. The thought was to cut down on traffic and pollution. Well, now, more than 40 years later, they've taken a big step toward actually doing it. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority Board voted on Wednesday to approve the toll rates for Manhattan's congestion pricing program. It's the first of its kind in the United States.
New York has more traffic than any place in the United States, and now we're doing something about it.
Under the plan, New York City will charge a daily toll of $15 a day for passenger vehicles driving in Manhattan south of 60th Street starting in mid-June. It will charge up to $36 for larger trucks and buses. The plan still faces a number of legal challenges, including from the state of New Jersey. The battle at the U.S. southern border continues. A U.S. appeals court has kept on hold a Republican-backed Texas law that would let state authorities arrest and prosecute people suspected of illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexican border. It's a statute that President Joe Biden's administration has argued intrudes on the authority of the federal government. Here's Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
The law would make it a state crime to illegally enter or re-enter Texas from a foreign country and would empower state judges to order that violators leave the United States, with prison sentences up to 20 years for those who refuse to comply. The Republican-backed law met immediate legal pushback from Democratic President Joe Biden's administration. The White House says the law oversteps the authority of the federal government to enforce immigration laws. The measure, formerly called SB 4, has zigzagged through federal courts. In February, a federal judge issued an injunction that blocked the law from taking effect. Then, last week, the Supreme Court ruled it could go into force. But hours later, the New Orleans-based Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals restored the injunction. And in a 2-1 ruling late on Tuesday, a Fifth Circuit panel denied Texas's appeal. The U.S. Justice Department and the Office of Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Biden and Democrats in Congress have tried to find a bipartisan deal to improve border security and reform the asylum system, but Republicans have so far rejected the proposals. A caravan of Central and South American migrants, many fleeing violence and poverty, set out this week from southern Mexico, hoping to reach the U.S. Antonio Peña is from Honduras and told Reuters he and others were seeking a legal alternative, but that many are opting to cross illegally. He said he was asking the U.S. to let them enter in a legal way. This migrant mother and her three children are from Colombia. Now they're sheltering along the bank of the Rio Grande. She said they've been there for almost 3 days. She said they have no water and eat whatever they are given, and that the cold at night was intense. They shiver and huddle with each other, she said. Immigration and security along the border with Mexico are hot topics for voters ahead of the November 5th U.S. election, in which the Democratic president is seeking a second term in office. Donald Trump, the Republican candidate challenging Biden, has promised to resume and expand the restrictive immigration policies of his prior presidency.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. An update now on the bridge collapse in the U.S. city of Baltimore. The Biden administration wants to rebuild the bridge. Here's Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani.
As the Baltimore recovery operation picks up steam, the Biden administration is focused on rebuilding and reopening. The key bridge's loss is a major commuter and commercial problem. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says it will be reconstructed, but he's not putting a timeline on it.
The original bridge took 5 years to construct. That does not necessarily mean it will take 5 years to replace.
As for reopening Baltimore's port, where no vessels are allowed in or out from now.
Too soon to venture an estimate.
Buttigieg was here at the White House to meet with President Biden alongside Coast Guard Vice Admiral Peter Gauthier, who says crews are working to clear the bridge's remnants from the Patapsco River and move the vessel that rammed the bridge.
The Coast Guard highest priority now is restoring the waterway for shipping.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
Okay, listen to this. The Earth is spinning faster. And that may cause timekeepers to subtract 1 second from all of the clocks in the world. Earth's changing spin is threatening to toy with our sense of time, our clocks, and our computerized society in an unprecedented way. For the first time in history, world timekeepers may have to consider subtracting a second from our clocks in a few years to compensate for the fact that the planet is rotating just a tad faster than it used to. Clocks may have to skip a second. It's called a negative leap second. Might happen around 2029. A study in the journal Nature said Wednesday that this is an unprecedented situation and a big deal. And finally, on April 8th, What's being billed as the astronomical event of the decade, a total eclipse of the sun, will be seen from the west coast of Mexico to the east coast of Canada, slicing diagonally across the United States as well. That includes Niagara Falls, where 1 million people are expected to gather to watch it happen. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner says business owners are getting ready.
Early spring is usually not a busy time for Niagara Falls, but this small Canadian tourist town is bracing for a record number of visitors, excited to see a rare total solar eclipse on April 8th.
We are preparing for up to 1 million people visiting our city at the same time.
Niagara Falls Mayor Jim Diodati.
Even though we get 14 million people every year, it's over the year. It's not all at one time. To get 1 million at one time would be by far the biggest crowd that we've ever had.
The solar eclipse is the first since 1979 in Canada and 2017 in the United States, encouraging many people to splurge on hotels and rentals in advance. The surge in visitors is also a plus for local businesses. Gabrielle Gabri is the owner of Bravo Pizzeria and Grill.
We're expecting to have a full house for the first time in a long time, right? We're coming up for the winter season. So it's an exciting time.
The Niagara region, which includes Niagara Falls, Niagara-on-the-Lake, and St. Catharines, has been named as the most booked destination in Canada for the solar eclipse. Jason Harlow is a physics professor at the University of Toronto.
It's an outdoor experience that you really want to share with your friends and your family, for sure. Having that collective feeling of, oh, the sun's gone, and you know, seeing something that's so rare and so beautiful, to see the stars come out in the day. It's something that my kids will remember their whole lives.
The next total eclipse in the United States isn't expected until 2044.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending the time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
14 members of the United Nations Security Council voted on March 25th in favor of a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza for the month of Ramadan, which began on March 10th and ends on April 9th. The United States abstained from the vote but did not veto it. The United States fully supports the resolution's critical objectives, that is, to bring about an immediate and sustainable ceasefire, secure the immediate release of all hostages, and help alleviate the tremendous suffering of Palestinian civilians in Gaza, who are in dire need of protection and life-saving humanitarian assistance, said United States Permanent Representative at the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. We are getting closer to a deal for an immediate ceasefire with the release of all hostages. But we are not there yet.
A ceasefire could have come about months ago if Hamas had been willing to release hostages. Months ago. Instead, Hamas continues to stand in the way of peace, to throw up roadblocks, cower in tunnels beneath Gaza cities and under civilian infrastructure, and hide among the civilian population.
We believe it was important for the Council to speak out and make clear that any ceasefire must come with the release of all hostages, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. But the only path to a durable end to this conflict is the release of all hostages.
Critically, a ceasefire and the release of hostages will allow much more humanitarian aid to get into Gaza at a time when famine is looming large, and provide an opportunity to work toward a sustainable cessation of hostilities, toward a future where Hamas can no longer threaten Israel and never repeat October 7th, and no longer control Gaza and use civilians as shields. Toward a future where Palestinians and Israelis live side by side in peace in two democratic states of their own.
We meet during the holy month of Ramadan. this should be a season of peace for Muslim communities around the world. Just as October 7th, Simchat Torah, should have been a day of peace for Jewish communities, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. This resolution rightly acknowledges that during the month of Ramadan, we must recommit to peace. Hamas can do that by accepting the deal on the table. A ceasefire can begin immediately with the release of the first hostage.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.